and welcome to the Stay at Home Schooling Mom podcast. My name is Ginny Suford. I am joined by my good buddy, Mary Ellen Barrett. And we have a terrific, sort of interesting, fun topic for you today. But before we get to our topic, we would like to ask you to take a look at Seton Home Study School. They are our primary sponsor. They do a fabulous job for us, and they do a fabulous job for their students and families. I believe we have about 16,000 students right now, Mary Ellen, if I'm not wrong.
Just a little bit over that. Mm-hmm.
We've been in business for 40 years. We have our own books that we publish ourselves. If you want to learn more about Seton Home Study, get on their website, www.setonhome.org. And lots of information on there. And they have a Facebook page, loads of places you can find out information. But anyhow, after you do that, please listen to our podcast. And today's sort of interesting, the idea of expanding your studies. You know, very often people will say, well, what curriculum should I get? Or should I buy a curriculum? Or should I get... But, okay, now you've figured out spelling and math and English and reading. There's more to homeschooling than that. You can really expand your studies, can't you, Mary Ellen?
You can. You can. It's very easy to get workbook and textbook fatigue, I think. Especially, I always found that to be true after the holidays. You know, January comes along, February, it's dark, it's cold, nobody wants to go anywhere. And you've just been staring at these books for a couple of months now, several months, and you can't take it anymore. So I always found this, the lap booking and notebooking and incorporating novels and like historic literature and even some fun videos and movies into the studies in those dark days of winter to be so enriching and enlivening. I actually did a video. There are two videos, I think, on Seton Home Study School's Facebook page. If you click on the video option, you scroll down, because it was a few years ago, about expanding your history. It was, I think it was the sixth grade book, medieval, whatever one that is, medieval. And I used the Seton book as a spine. And then I had all kinds of different ideas of how to incorporate all of that knowledge while making it fun. So if you're interested in that, go to that Facebook page. But learning doesn't have to be dry and boring, right? Right, Ginny? We can have fun at this.
The way I have to admit, you're probably a lot more inventive than I am. But I was a big believer, just get the kids out of the house a little bit. I lived in Chicago.
Yeah.
You couldn't have a better place. So we did museums, we did zoos, we did planetariums, we did aquariums, we did history museums. Sometimes you can just find a restored schoolhouse someplace.
Yeah.
So I did a lot of trips. I mean, that was a biggie, but not everybody lives in Chicago, I'm willing to admit. I know you used lap books quite a bit, didn't you?
I did. And it was fun because, like, I have lap books that my oldest son, Ryan, started, and every kid added to them. So Brendan finished them up.
Oh, wow. So that's cool.
It's cool. It's a nice little keepsake.
Yeah, that's cool.
So we have one that's for the solar system. So Ryan started it and he wrote some stuff in it. And then each kid has, as they've learned more about the solar system, where they went through that chapter or unit, I forget what it was, they would add their notes and their pictures and their stuff. So the thing is like an encyclopedia. It's huge. It's falling apart, but it's one of my treasures. We have that one and a plant one. And then I also had them do a lap book. They did one on St. Nicholas, and I cut red folders into the shape of a miter's hat.
Oh, that's cool.
Yeah. So they did. It was like a December fun activity, and we decorated it. And then they wrote a little prayer to St. Nicholas and a little thing about the Bishop of Smyrna and all this kind of stuff. And so it just became a fun, creative way to kind of enhance whatever study you're doing. Because it can be a little bit dry to just, you know, fill in the blank at the end of the chapter, fill in the blank at the end of the chapter, fill in the blank at the end of the chapter.
We want to excite them.
Yeah.
One of the things I did with the younger kids, you go out and collect leaves. Go out and collect leaves. And then I used to get those, their photo albums. I don't even know if they sell them anymore, but they had clear plastic and you were supposed to put your photo in the clear plastic behind the clear plastic. But you can do that with leaves too.
Oh, that's neat.
You can do that with leaves. And then we'd have to identify the leaf. Is it an oak or is it a maple or is it a sycamore or whatever? And it was, again, kind of a fun thing for the time of year when, you know, that's all I see around them is falling leaves. So that was kind of a fun thing that we did. There's loads of projects. I did more notebooking, though, I would have to say.
Yeah,
notebooking, you could do that on almost anything. You could keep a history or a science notebook, a nature notebook, whatever. But I did it mostly, I have to tell you, in the early grades. So one of the big problems that I think students in the United States in general have, and Seton, even though my kids were always enrolled in Seton, and Seton does a great job with composition. Mm-hmm. And you'll hear Seton grad parents say, oh, they got to college, boy, and they could write better than anybody.
It's true. They do an excellent job of teaching you how to write compositions and book reports and things like that.
But I will admit that the year that I was homeschooling seven kids, a lot of that writing is in the lesson plans. And I was like hanging on for dear life.
Oh, sure.
To be perfectly honest with you. So what I would do in the early grades is they would have, we called it morning work, but they had a little notebook. When I could get it, I'd buy like the black and white marble notebooks, but they had the ones that had the different color lines, like for the primary students.
Yeah, yeah.
So it's easier for them to print. And they would have to do, and in the early grades, like in beginning of first grade, I would write and they had to copy. So it might be something like, today is Wednesday, November 1st, 2023. It is a sunny day. We had a thermometer outside the kitchen window. And they learned how to read the temperature. Oh. So then they would have to say the temperature is, you know, whatever, 35 degrees at 11:30 a.m. Today we are going to the zoo.
And you were in Chicago, so that was June, right?
No, actually, we would go sometimes. The Brookfield Zoo has a really cool thing, actually, in the winter, where they put up all these Christmas decorations and stuff. It's real, and for Halloween, they do Boo at the Zoo. Because they do want to keep kids coming in the middle of the winter and you have to really entice them. But anyhow, so say that on a day like that, when the kid, so then we went to the next day, they're going to write, today is Wednesday, November 2nd, 2023, and go through, it's a cloudy day, and what the temperature was at what time of the day. And maybe then they draw a picture. Yesterday, when we went to the zoo, we saw zebras.
Yeah. I had the similar notebooks, but at the top half of the page was blank. Like framed out so they could draw a picture, and then below it they could write. So
we,
I did that when they were
too.
Yeah, when they were real little. So they draw a picture, maybe write a line or two about the picture or something like that. Like it was always related.
You can even
find
like a bear, a picture of a bear that's, you know, just black and white, and glue it to the top of the page and the kids color it.
Yeah. Yeah, you could just be a little creative. And it's a nice thing for them to have just that practice of writing, but it's only two or three lines, so it's not so intimidating, so you can still make it fun. I once even printed out, I think I got it on Pinterest. Maybe it was before Pinterest, I don't know. Journal prompts for second graders or something like that. And I tore them up and put them in a jar. And so they would, and that was just something for them to do that was a little different for that month. You know, they'd pick out a journal prompt and it would say, you know, write a line about, you know, what color the sky is today, or tell something about your grandma or something like that, you know, something that's one or two sentences. So I think you probably Pinterest has that kind of stuff.
We're kind of making it out though, that it's just sort of a fun breakup, which it is, don't get me wrong. But if you use the example that I gave before, the kids have now in first, second or third grade, because this is when I did it, they've written the day of the week, the date with the comma and, you know, where it belongs,
and
the proper
the year.
Place. They know how to read a thermometer. They know how to write down the temperature is. They know how to start a sentence with a capital letter and end it with a period, which is interesting. Of course, all that is covered in any English workbook I've ever seen in my life. You know, the sentence starts with a capital letter and ends with a period. But you notice how kids don't always do it when they go to write their own stuff.
Right. Yeah, they forget. It's easy to do it in the notebook, in the workbook, but then transferring that over to the notebook, for some reason, there's, I don't know, a disconnect there. So when they have that practice, like you said, I also like to have them write their name and address, because that's the kind of thing you forget to teach them as homeschoolers.
That's what made me think about the date, why I always put the date in, because the first couple of years I homeschooled, I never wrote the date down. Why did I have to? I knew where we were. And then all of a sudden I realized I had these fifth graders didn't know how to write a date.
I once had a 13-year-old ask me what our zip code was. And I was embarrassed.
But that is a good point, though. So the thing with notebooking, too, is that you can add whatever you feel you need to do.
Yeah.
You could, if you're going to be going to a family reunion around the holidays, you can have the kids write down everybody's name, you know, that they don't see all the time. Yeah. I'm going to be seeing Uncle Bill and Aunt Irene. They live in Connecticut. They have three children, the children's name, you know what I'm saying? So you could almost include anything in your notebook that you wanted to in the early grades to just catch the kids up. So they're not meeting their uncle and going, who's he? You know?
For years, I had the kids keep liturgical notebooks. And what I did was I bought those, I think they were 1-inch, the white binders where you could slide the piece of paper in the cover to make a cover.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
And then whatever we were doing in religion or whatever feast day or whatever liturgical thing was going on, I would find a coloring page or a puzzle page, or I would have them, like I would have them tell me the story of, say, the saint. And then I would write it out lightly in pencil and they would copy over it, maybe draw a little picture, stick a holy card on there or something.
Right.
And I would slide it in. And at the end of the year, I just put in tabs for the months. And then they had a liturgical notebook for the year. And then every year we would go back to September and start all over again. So by the time they got really too old for it, which was about fourth grade, they got sick of it. They had like a really big notebook of all these little things that they did to record their feast days and things like that. And then I also had to make first communion notebooks too. So those two are nice little keepsakes and little traditions that we kind of developed in our homeschool, but they still learned a lot. And they didn't know they were learning anything because it was fun. Because maybe I read them a picture book and we had tea and cookies and they colored a paper. And then I just put it in their religion notebook and boom, they learned something. But they were having fun. So they didn't know they were learning.
Yeah, I agree.
It's not going to know that stuff.
Lots of times. We want to excite their imaginations a little bit. So yeah. Whether it's collecting leaves or whether it's talk. So actually just collecting leaves is just sort of a fun thing. They still learned the names of different trees.
Right. Yeah. And they didn't realize they would do. They were outside getting some fresh air and looking at pretty leaves and sticking them in albums. And oh, by the way, they learned what the different leaves are by the time they'd done that four or five times. They could identify a tree.
I think your liturgical notebook idea is great because we want our kids to learn all these things. Maybe these special prayers to the Blessed Mother or today I went to Mass and they did the Litany of the Saints.
Yeah. Isn't that nice?
It is. It's lovely. So maybe your kids learn how to say their rosary today, or they learn how to say their Chaplet of Divine Mercy, and maybe they draw a picture of a rosary. And like you say, they're learning, but they really don't think of it as learning. It's not the same thing as sitting there and trying to decide whether something's a proper noun or a common noun.
Right. When they're little, you could have them doing like coloring books with, I don't know, Mickey Mouse or Power Rangers or whatever the thing is now, or you could have them doing coloring books with the Blessed Mother and some saints. And so they're learning a little bit during school time. Now, there's nothing wrong with coloring a picture of Mickey Mouse. You know, if that's your jam, go ahead. But if you're practicing those fine motor skills and you're wanting to get that in there, it's just a fun way for them to kind of attach themselves to their faith and learn a few facts about whatever saint or whatever thing you want them to learn about.
Yeah, I think, and this is, I think, especially useful if you're studying a particular time in history.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Definitely. Did you ever do a timeline? We did a timeline a few years, and that is a lot of fun. My kids loved that. And they, like I've told you before, my kids aren't particularly scholarly. they're all pretty smart and everything, but they weren't the kind who would just willfully sit down and start diving into their academics.
Like those homeschooling books you read?
They did not.
Sitting
they
at just, mother's feet, just waiting for her next word.
I'd have to drag them kicking and screaming sometimes to this table. It's time for school. Sit down. But they love to do this kind of like timelines and coloring the pictures and noting the date and what happened. And especially if there was a battle, the boys like that. And we studied about swords and about armor, and I would take books out of the library about the different war things that people were wearing at that time in history. So helmets and what do you call those things? The crest, the things with the crest on them. You know what I mean?
Sure.
I should ask one of my kids. So you can really make that kind of stuff. So the Battle of Hastings, 1066, what were they wearing? What kind of weapons were they using? You know, it doesn't have to be all this dry memorization of dates. Like there can be exciting things in it too.
And I think another way of really bringing that alive is getting historical novels. Personally, I love them. I love history. I've read the adult ones. I still do Jeff Scheherazade. Gettysburg, his dad wrote, and then since then he's written books about the Revolutionary War and the Civil War and World War I. I love historical fiction. especially when most of the time it's fairly accurate, not always, but fairly accurate, but it brings kids there. In fact, that was the original, the American Dolls. I think they've gone a little bit off the beam. They're completely
off the rails now, but I still have them packed away. The Molly doll from World War II and, oh my goodness.
It was Samantha was one of them.
Samantha was the revolution. We have her. I don't know. Addie. We have her.
And the books were kind of cool because they told the kid what it is like to live, you know, in the South during the Civil War type of thing, as opposed to just reading it somewhere. I think it also, in my mind, it also gives our kids a little picture. You know, there's a lot of talk today, as we're recording this podcast, about like how unreliable young people are. Employers don't want to hire them.
Right. Yeah, that's true.
You know, it's a big problem right now. And then of course I get the Wall Street Journal and you get these young women writing about, I want to be a lazy girl. I'm out of college, but I shouldn't have to work 40 hours a week. I can live in my parents' basement and work 20 hours a week and have a nice life.
Some girl on Instagram recently, she went viral. She was crying. And I felt sorry for her until I realized she was crying because she had to work 9 to 5 and she didn't get home until almost 6 o'clock and she just left her no time for a life. Oh my gosh. First of all, don't do that online.
Don't make a fool out of yourself online. Talk to your friends or something. Don't make a fool of your mom.
Don't do that. And second of all, like she was working just a bare 40 hours a week and she just felt that was just altogether too much. Whereas you read something about like Laura Ingalls, who worked from like dawn till dusk, constant work.
Well, I think
I was happy.
Laura Ingalls Wilder's book, Farmer Boy, which is about her husband's childhood in Malone, New York. Now, for those of you who are not from New York, by the way, I've never heard of Malone either until I read the books and then I looked it up. It's not exactly at the North Pole. You can see the North Pole from there. I mean, Malone, New York is all the way up there. It is really on an iceberg.
New York is big. People don't realize that. Right. People think of Manhattan, maybe Westchester, Long Island. New York goes right up to Canada. I mean, it's huge.
Well, and this place is right there. Believe me when I tell you.
It's cold.
And if you read the book, Farmer Boy, it takes place around the time of his 9th birthday. And for his 9th birthday, little Elmonzo gets an ox yoke. Yes, that's the wooden thing that you put on two oxen. And he puts them on the oxen and he's training his oxen calves.
That's what he got for his 9-year-old
kid.
He got a big job. That's what he got.
Well, his dad also, but this was an exciting thing for him. And his dad also made him a sled, I have to say. So he had a sled too, which was more fun. But he thought it was a lot of fun to train ox calves. He thought this was a whole lot of fun. And it just talks about when you learn about Elmonzo and his brother, and he had a couple of sisters too, and they would get up first thing in the morning and they would go out and muck out the stables and feed the animals and water them. And then they would come in and have breakfast. And then after that, they would walk, you know, 2 miles in the freezing cold in June. I'm sure it's freezing cold up there. They would walk to school and then they would walk home from school at the end of that day. And then before they were allowed to go in to get a snack or anything, they would immediately have to go back out to the barn and take care of these animals again. And I think, you know, in our time, we're thrilled if they make their bed.
Yeah. It's absolutely true. You can give your kids kind of a picture of what life was like before everybody got to be so whiny.
No kidding.
Like, and you like the historic fiction about the American saga. My daughters and I all love anything related to Tudor or the Stuarts, all that kind of stuff. And if you read, there's a series called, it might be The Princess Diaries, not the movie, but they're little gold books. You can find them in the library. And they're just, they're diary form of all of these queens and princesses in history. Now, Queen Elizabeth I, you know, dreadful person, horrible. But by the time she was 14, she could speak, read, and write, I think it was 4 languages.
Right.
And she was a very knowledgeable person for the knowledge of her time. She had an interest in science and astronomy and all these things that women weren't supposed to be interested in. she was 14 and she knew all this. And now it's like getting a 14-year-old, like you said, to make their bet. So it kind of inspires kids, I think, also when you kind of fill in their history rather than just the textbook or the workbook, you fill it in with actual, as close as you can get to real life accounting.
And what they can do.
Yeah, it shows.
John Stuart them. Mill, when I first started homeschooling, I read about John Stuart Mill because he's sort of a famous homeschooler in history. And John Stuart Mill was like teaching his brothers and sisters Latin and Greek when he was seven.
So, yeah. I mean, you're capable now, you know, you're a homeschool mom with eight kids and you're busy. You're not going to have your 10-year-old learning Latin and Greek and Hebrew and all that stuff.
It's and teaching it to his younger siblings. But we could expect a whole lot more.
Yeah. And wouldn't it be nice if they read something and said, hey, I would like to do that. You know, read a biography of John James Audubon. And say, right. Oh, I'd love to go outside and draw some birds.
Or the Wright brothers. I'd love to come up with a great adventure. Or Thomas Edison, who was homeschooled and at one point in history held the most patents of any inventor.
Right. It's like that's inspiring to kids. And if you get them at the right time with the right book, the right guy, the right story, you really can set them on a path. And that kind of can show you where their gifts and talents lie, which is a whole other podcast.
Well, it is. And again, teaching kids also maybe not to always look within themselves, which we are a navel gazing country right now.
Oh, we are. We're a whole society of nasal gazing.
Yeah. We're very selfish. And our kids, you know, they whine if they don't have their own cell phone at 14 because all my friends have one, you know, that sort of thing. But if you think of Laura Ingalls Wilder wrote about when she was 15, she went to a neighboring town, slept on a couch and taught school. Remember, she didn't have a room or anything. She slept on a couch in somebody's cabin and taught school. And she did it to make money, not for herself, but so that her parents could send her sister to the blind school.
Right. Yes. I remember that now.
So how about we, you know, our kids learn that, and my dad drove a milk truck around the Bronx when he was 14. And the money got turned in. It wasn't like he kept this money and put it in his own pocket. So he could buy a better pair of jeans, you know.
Yeah, we've lost that kind of sensibility of helping out your family. You know, if kids work, it's because they want sneakers or a cell phone or a movie tickets or whatever else. And my own kids too. Like they save for their own things, but it's not like anybody's kicking in for the electric bill.
but there is a lot to be said for hearing that there were times when people did that, when everybody in the family worked so that the family could have a place to live and eat.
Yeah, it was just that desperate.
In harder times. And I think that's really good for our kids to learn. And maybe it'll cut back on the whining, like, but why can't I have that? All my friends do.
But it also makes it more enjoyable to learn when you get to those like real life stories, rather than, you know, reading about George Washington in the textbook. You read historic fiction involving him and some story, maybe him playing with his friends or something like that. There's tons of books out there about him. And realize
Abe Lincoln. Growing up in the woods.
Extraordinary men. Yeah,
in Indiana, or well, he was born in Kentucky, moved to Indiana, went to Illinois eventually. That's a cool visit, by the way. If you ever get to Old New Salem in Illinois, that's a recreation of this, the town where Lincoln lived. But really, really cool stories. When his mom died, which is fairly commonly known, his dad like left him and his sister in the middle of the woods. They were 10 and 12 years old while he went off to find another wife. I mean, it's just, these types of things are so extraordinary. Andrew Jackson was an orphan with no siblings or anything by the time he was maybe 14 and basically raised himself.
Yeah.
So great for our kids, I think, to learn that first of all, they can have higher expectations for themselves, but also, again, you're just learning about Andrew Jackson, you know, that he won the Battle of New Orleans. That's interesting, but it's so much cooler. To see it through his eyes or to see it through the eyes of one of his soldiers when they write books about that type of thing.
Yeah. So the point is to be a little creative. When you see the chapter coming up in the history book or the science book or the religion, kind of think ahead to maybe how can we make this a little bit more interesting. It doesn't have to be just textual. And on that note, we have to take a break here because we've been going on a bit. As we do.
Seton Home Study is our primary sponsor, and we're very grateful to them. But we have other sponsors and great Catholics all. So please take a listen.
It's great. I think my seat in education really gave me a lot of the truth, but it was cool to go into an area where you could dialogue with other people and kind of pursue the truth in a different way than just than receiving it. To learn not only in the class how to be good or what is good, but then to also learn outside the class, learning from learning through relationship. I've grown so much as an individual because I can engage not only with the text we read in class, but anything I encounter in the world, I am able to say, okay, this is Hegel talking. I can figure out how to find the truth with people who don't even really know how to dialogue well, because I've been taught so well how to dialogue in the classroom and outside of the classroom with sparring with friends.
I'm Anthony
Klein, a Seton Home Studies School graduate and a junior here at Belmont Abbey's Honors College.
The Honors College at Belmont Abbey. To learn more, visit www.bac.edu/honors.
Thank you to our sponsors. We are delighted to be back here. We are talking about enriching your studies, expanding your studies with different things to kind of combat textbook fatigue, and also to really kind of have your kids immerse themselves in the time or the place or the subject matter that you're trying to present to them and have them enjoy it. Make it a little bit more fun. Make it a little more lighthearted. We're recording this on the 1st of November, so blessed feast day to everybody. Happy All Saints Day. This will be posted in a few weeks, but I hope you had a nice time. And it's cold. I'm cold. We turned on the heat today. So when you're in the dark depths of winter, which are coming, it's fun to be a little bit more creative with your studies and do some more interesting things. So we're going to talk a little bit about videos and maybe movies, which can be a little bit touchy, right, for some people, because not everybody has the same standards.
Well, first of all, people, for good reason, by the way, very often, do not trust the internet. And I get why. Believe me, I am a big believer in keeping your computer in a public place in the house where everybody can see it. Mm-hmm. There's all sorts of software now where parents can be notified if their kids get on certain websites, that sort of thing. Big believer in that. However, just because online content can be very problematic doesn't mean that some of it can't be absolutely great.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. Every year on Martin Luther King Day, we can pull up on YouTube and watch his I Have a Dream speech.
Yeah.
Like, that's amazing to me. That's amazing to me that we can see these things. Well, Churchill's speech, in his own words, you can't see it because obviously it wasn't filmed. We will meet them at the beaches. We will meet them at, you know, that one that he gave to Parliament.
Well, the Day of Infamy speech by Roosevelt.
These are all audio recordings, but of course they put pictures up on YouTube. You can hear these things in the voices of the men and women who first said them. And that's really amazing. That's really amazing. So you have to take advantage of that because we do have it. And it's not a bad thing.
No, it's a great thing. And I think one area where it's especially valuable is science.
Oh, yeah.
Because your kids cannot look. Just trust me on this. They can't look inside a beehive in person. Just not a good plan. Don't do that. They can look inside a beehive online.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, there's a lot of good stuff when it comes to that. Yes, absolutely.
Science, you could Google a video of a heart beating and you get to see what a heartbeat looks like. Mm-hmm. Or I know when we were studying science, I was studying science with my grandkids, and there was a tsunami in Japan several years ago, but it was still recent enough that you could actually see the wave come in and the size of it, and it hit the city. And it was just, that's what a tsunami looks like when it hit Japan. You're not reading it in a book.
Yeah, you're seeing it. And that is the huge advantage of the times that we live in, and the internet and all this kind of viral stuff, is that you do actually get to witness history in a way that people even 20 years ago couldn't.
Like, you can see Mount St. Helens erupt.
Yeah, you could see
blow the top of the mountain off. I mean, basically.
I mean, for your older kids, you can see the towers come down. I mean, it's a pretty gruesome thing. I would be careful about that. And that's another point to make, is that before you show these kinds of things to your children, view them first yourself.
Yeah, check it out yourself.
Skim through it real fast, just to make sure that there's nothing that you don't want them to see, or maybe you have a sensitive child and they don't want to see, you know, a million people getting swept away in a wave or something like that. You know your children and you know what your standards are. But there's a lot of good stuff there out on, particularly YouTube. That's a good one. you have to be careful of ads with YouTube. Now they've kind of gotten my algorithm. So my ads tend to focus on like cleaning products and grocery type things, you know, that kind of thing. So it's pretty benign. But you want to just be careful that the ads are pretty benign and they're, if you're not paying for it, which I don't, because I pay for as little as possible, I'm so cheap, that your ads aren't going to interfere with, you know, your children's innocence in any way.
But on the other hand, I've seen, for example, I love these. They put a camera inside like an eagle's nest.
Oh yeah. Isn't that neat?
They put a camera inside the eagle's nest and, you'll see the eagles being hatched. You'll see the mother feeding them. You'll see them taking, you know, growing their pin feathers, mm-hmm. then growing their big feathers. It's just so cool. It is so absolutely cool. You'll never get an opportunity. You're not going to be able to stick your head in an eagle's nest.
No,
I highly recommend against it.
The Discovery Channel and Discovery Kids has a lot of that kind of stuff that's really neat. They have a lot of, like, Discovery Kids, I'm not as huge a fan of. They have a lot of stupid cartoons. But they do have a lot of really good stuff for that kind of thing, the sciencey things, mountain climbing, or, you know, stuff that's good for your kids to look at. And, you know, maybe doesn't necessarily have to anything to do with your studying, with what you're studying at the moment, but it's educational, it's fun to watch, it's a good way to kill a rainy afternoon, you know, put on something about sharks or whales. My son loved anything with predatory bent.
Yes.
Shark Week
was very
about.
Popular in my household
yeah.
too.
Lions,
but there's lots of nature shows.
Like
those I think are the best. Are the nature shows?
Yes.
Like you'll see the Serengeti.
Yeah.
And all the animals
yeah.
that live there. That is so. And you'll never be unless you have more money than Mary Ellen and I can even dream about. You're never going to actually get to the Serengeti. Sorry.
Do you remember Mutual of Omaha's Wild Kingdom?
Yes, I do remember Mutual of Omaha's Wild Kingdom.
We watch that every Sunday night. I love that show. I still love to watch those kinds of shows.
I do too. I do too. So don't, and videos, by the way, you can also find videos on how to diagram a sentence.
Or you can.
Or how, my one daughter is married to a man who was born in Russia and he speaks Russian. And there's a online program to teach the kids Russian. My daughter doesn't speak any Russian. I said, why don't you, you know, let the kids do that? And I'm not a big believer in online education, but she doesn't speak Russian and he has a full-time job.
Right. So, I mean, there are things where it really makes sense. And that is one of those things that really makes sense. You can watch recordings of the New York Philharmonic playing Mozart or operas, you know, that you might never get to see. I mean, a lot of people aren't going to get to the Met. So, but you can watch Paiacci live recorded from the Met. A lot of that stuff is
on Nessun Dorma, his signature piece. I mean,
yes.
to get to see that once is incredible. You can replay it if you want.
A lot of those things are on, I think it's Netflix has a lot of that kind of opera stuff, one of the streaming services, but that's an extraordinary thing to expose your children to.
Absolutely. You can do that in so many areas, things that you'd never be able to see. So, for example, again, Mary Ellen and I both lived in New York. You could take your kids to the Metropolitan Museum of Art, which is Fifth Avenue in the 80s there.
Yeah.
Well, some of you can't get there, but they have these things. They have them online now. You can take a tour of the Louvre or a tour of the Met or a tour of the Frick or a tour of the Chicago Art Institute. Now, you might not get to see absolutely every picture, but you'll get to see some of them.
Yeah, you'll get to see enough to give you an idea. And then maybe you go to the library and take out one of those big art books and say, all right, this is what else Renoir painted. And you look at that. And maybe then you go to the art store and you buy a couple of prints and you hang them up and you have the children looking at them all the time. And that's just a way to enhance your studies. And it makes sense. It's these resources are available to you. It takes a little bit of the burden off you. I don't know that much about opera. I know a few that I like, but let's watch something about it and learn it. Let's be cultured people for 5 minutes. Of course, I say this opera, like my kids wanted to kill me every time I put on the opera. They had no interest. They wanted to watch the Beatles documentary. They did not want to watch the opera.
I think that though does bring up a really good point that maybe we should talk about. I think TV in general and children's program absolutely is sort of very passive.
Yes.
It's very easy to understand.
True.
It's very uncomplicated. Most adults hate it. But I'm just talking about like the cartoon stuff at the early years. Or then later on, basically what I see, and I make my grandkids turn it off all the time, it's like snotty preteens.
Oh, yeah. Even back when my older kids were little, like that Caillou, I wanted to punch that little cartoon. He was the whiniest little pain in the neck. Like, this is just teaching them to whine and be snotty. And I don't like it. Turn
but
it off.
But again, it's very passive. It doesn't require any intellectual engagement, I guess is what I'm trying to say. And that's why, so we're going to do a whole podcast, and Mary Ellen and I are working on a podcast now about teaching music to your kids at home.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And one of the things that we can talk about is, because of the internet, you have this opportunity to see all this great stuff. Now, here's the thing. Your 8-year-old daughter would rather watch a Disney princess movie.
Sure.
And listen to that music. And that's not all bad. I mean, that's okay.
No,
but if that's all they're ever exposed to, again, they're kind of passive. They don't engage. Whereas if you're watching Swan Lake or The Nutcracker, or, you know, that requires more intellectual engagement.
Yeah, that Disney kind of music, and it's fun and it's popular and it's fine. You know, it's fine to have on in the background once in a while, but it doesn't challenge you. There's no complexity to those rhythms and melodies and things like that. It doesn't challenge you. There's no, like, if you're listening to, say, Mozart's Jupiter Symphony, there's so much complexity in that, and it's such a beautiful piece of work. And then you can see how each movement relates to another. And then you look up what influenced him to, why did he compose this? Who is Mozart? What did he do? You know, I mean, there's just so many good stories there. Whereas if you're watching a princess movie, or even, you know, something that's even a little better, like a Fantasia or something like that. Okay. You know,
the thing is, it's passive.
It's passive. It's entertaining. Passive.
You're sitting there and it's flowing into you, and it doesn't require any engagement or any intellectual or any questioning of it. Like if you hear, my mind is going, who do we just talk about singing Nessun Dorma? Pavarotti. You hear Pavarotti singing Nessun Dorma. Well, it's very, very inspiring just to listen to him at the end when his voice goes up and everything. What's he saying?
Oh, yeah.
It's in Italian. We don't know. But you can look up what he's saying.
Yeah. Or you can go to the library and get the book. They have books of the opera. I mean, I knock the library a lot because there's a lot of nonsense in there nowadays, but it is an actual really good resource for things like that, that you're not going to actually, you know, find in your local Barnes & Noble or something.
Yeah, don't go in June.
Yeah, just don't go in June. You just order it all, pick it up on May 30th, and don't go back till July 1st.
Don't go in June.
Pay the fees.
but other than that, there are tremendous things. And if you can't afford a subscription to the National Geographic or to this or to that, you can get those things for free at the library.
Yeah, you can.
Even as I was talking about foreign language, you can go to most public libraries, either have videos or something you can get, or sometimes they have like an online program that you can get for free through your library card.
Yeah.
Where you can, and it'll be like, there was one that they had, Timsler put it out. I don't know if they still have it, Little Tim. And it's basically teaching language for little kids. So your kids can learn how to speak French.
Oh, that's neat. Yeah.
And it's done very simply, you know.
I had some kind of language program for the kids when they were little from the library. It was a Rosetta Stone, but it was something similar to that. It was probably pre-Rosetta Stone, that you could just take out and keep. I think you could keep it for like 3 months.
Yeah.
You know, it wasn't even like the normal library time, because it was considered an educational resource. So anyway, there are lots of resources you can get inexpensively, fairly easily, that will enhance all of these kinds of studies. And you want this well-rounded, educated child. You know, we tend to think of educated as just the academics. They have to learn their math. They have to learn their history. They have to learn their religion. They have to learn their English. But you want them to be fairly well-rounded, and exposing them to all of the arts and exposing them to these different resources and having them see all of these neat things on the science channels and stuff really rounds them out as people, I think. It's very liberal arts. I'm a liberal arts
very
kind
liberal
of a person.
Arts.
Yeah, it's what it's supposed to be. It's what education is. You're educating the whole person. So think of them
as... I guess what we're trying to say to you here, to round this up sort of, is that while we do have to do the grunt work, they still have to learn their multiplication tables. They still have to learn their 8 parts of speech. They still have to learn, you know, the Columbus discovered America in 1492. You can bring it alive.
Yeah.
And there's loads of ways to do that, whether you do it through lap booking or notebooking or videos or historical novels or getting online and seeing the inside of a beehive. There's loads of ways of making education really something that the kids want.
Yeah.
They want to do.
And it's more fun for you too. as a mom. It's more interesting. It really is. We're going to put some of these resources in the show notes, some ideas to kind of spark your creativity. But in the meantime, we want to thank our sponsor again, Seton Home Study School, for sponsoring us. They're a great friend to the podcast. We'd like to thank our producer and engineer person, Jason Lowry. He is intensely patient with us. And show notes are written by Jim Shanley. And our social media kind of graphic stuff is Robin Hibble. And we could not do this without the three of them at all. So we are very, very grateful to them and everybody at Seton Home Study School. And what I guess that wraps it up, huh, Jen?
Well, except we are also grateful to our listeners. Mary Ellen and I have to tell you, we are shocked. We just thought, oh, let's do a podcast. That sounds nice. We were sort of dumb going into this. We admit it. And we have been shocked at the wonderful number of wonderful reviews and the number of people that have liked our Facebook page, number of people who have asked questions or made comments or said it was a help. So please, wherever you listen to podcasts, if you don't mind, go, you know, Spotify or whatever, go over there, find us, give us a nice 5-star rating. If you want to give us less than that, don't bother. You don't have to do that.
Don't strain yourself for that.
Don't strain yourself in that case. But we thank you all for our reception. We are very, very grateful.
Yeah, we're coming up on a year.
Yeah, we sure are.
Yeah, we're coming up on a year.
Time flies when you're having fun.
Yeah. So we will see you again next Wednesday afternoon when the next podcast drops. And in the meantime, have a great week and God bless.
God bless.
And now we'd like to take a moment to thank our sponsor, Seton Home Study School. Seton Home Study School is a nationally accredited, faithfully Catholic, private distant learning school that serves students from pre-K through 12th grade. There are currently 17,000 homeschool students enrolled in Seton Home Study School and many, many more who use their books and materials, including several small Catholic schools. Since 1983, Seton Home Study School has faithfully served the homeschool community in the United States and all over the world. Please check out their website, setonhome.org, for more information. And thank you, Seton Home Study School, for sponsoring the podcast, The Stay-at-Home Schooling Moms.